Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading figures from the world of sustainability and explore the sustainability agenda in marketing and strategy, technology, innovation, investment and finance. We look at the latest thinking, what's working, and the future and evolution of the sustainability agenda.
Sustainability refers to the ability of the corporation to produce not only financial performance, but also environmental and social performance through its operations, through its business model, and do so in a way that the socio-environmental performance is complementary, synergistic to an organization's financial performance. The leading companies do not, by definition, right? They don't expect to be led by anyone. They take their own initiative, they change their operations, they change their structure, their governance structure, they change their degree of transparency and accountability of the entire organization. They adopt long-term horizons and they, as I mentioned, they lead towards this way. And in the process, coming up often enough with better products, higher profitability, while having a positive impact in the broader socio-environmental context.
I'm very pleased today to be speaking to Professor Yanis Yanou. Yanis is a professor of strategy and entrepreneurship at London Business School and a sustainability scholar. His research focuses on sustainability and corporate social responsibility to understand the ways in which companies can and do contribute towards building a sustainable future. Much of Yanis's research is focused on how investors respond to companies that integrate environmental and social issues into strategy. He also studies the different factors that drive or hinder environmentally and socially responsible strategies. Well, thank you very much, Yanis, for taking the time to speak to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. It's a great honor to have an opportunity to speak to you and discuss latest thinking in sustainability, some of your research, and some other ideas.
Thank you very much for having me. It's truly a pleasure.
So can you tell me a little bit about your work, Yanis, and kind of research that you've been doing?
Right. So in my work, I'm a strategy scholar, and I'm trying to understand the extent to which and how the business organization is contributing towards a sustainable future. So in this respect, I explore the way that companies decide to engage with society, and in particular, the ways through which companies integrate environmental and social issues within their strategies and within their business models. More specifically, within that broader domain, I try to understand the performance implications of companies that integrate these issues, that integrate sustainability, in other words, into their business model and their strategy. And when I talk about performance, I of course mean financial performance, but also in terms of how capital markets perceive, assess, and evaluate these integration efforts by companies. That's one stream. The second stream tries to understand why do companies engage in social environmental issues to begin with. In other words, what are the drivers that push or hinder companies from engaging on these issues? And trying to understand why do we observe so much variance, in other words, so much heterogeneity in the corporate ability to achieve socio-environmental performance. In other words, why are some companies better or worse at achieving environmental and social performance? So in that stream, I look at institutional factors, regulatory factors, all the way down to cognitive factors. In other words, even the way that managers think about these issues. So broadly speaking, that is what I that is my sustainability agenda, my sustainability research agenda. The drivers of and the implications of efforts by corporates to integrate environmental and social issues.
Great, great. Very broad ranging interest there from the, you say, the performance aspect to the drivers. And it's very, very interesting to have an opportunity to talk to you, because it seems to me that quite often there's a deeply embedded idea that there's a trade-off between sustainability and profitability, that there's a cost of sustainability, which somehow means that profits will be less. And sometimes also in terms of the product dimension, that maybe the performance might be less, or indeed there might be a higher price to pay. So there's some deeply embedded ideas about sustainability. Just looking at the first of those in terms of profitability, what does your research and the latest thinking show about that?
I would say that the latest thinking in sustainability has moved beyond that trade-off. And what do we mean by that? It used to be the case that the term sustainability referred to predominantly environmental initiatives by the corporation. Increasingly, though, the word sustainability is used in order to basically talk about the sustainability of a competitive advantage, and therefore the ability of the firm to survive not only in the economic sense, but also in the environmental and the social sense. In other words, sustainability of a company, in my mind at least, and I think increasingly so in the minds of many academics and practitioners, sustainability refers to the ability of the corporation to produce not only financial performance, but also environmental and social performance through its operations, through its business model, and do so in a way that the socio-environmental performance is complementary, synergistic to an organization's financial performance. Therefore, if you take the example of green products, for instance, and you're right in saying that the dilemma is usually, should I meet the environmental credentials and therefore have a more expensive product, or should I go with a brown product that is cheaper? In other words, the trade-off is between environmental credentials and cost. So by this definition of sustainability, a company that offers an expensive green product has not really addressed the underlying trade-off, because it might be a product that is sustainable in its environmental domain, but that is probably a product that is not sustainable in its financial domain. In other words, I would say that the modern movement in sustainability, it's about exactly identifying these trade-offs, which we can broadly define as trade-offs between stakeholders. This example is between cost and the environment, but you can imagine there's a range of other trade-offs. For instance, the trade-off between the time it takes to implement this strategy and the patience of one's shareholder base. So the short-term versus the long-term trade-off, in other words. So sustainability is increasingly being understood as a mapping of a company's stakeholders, a profound understanding of the trade-offs that exist across those stakeholders. And importantly, when we talk about integration of these issues into a business model, it basically means that we come up with a business model that efficiently and profitably resolves these trade-offs. So in the product example, a sustainable company would be a company that has a product that at the very least meets the quality standards of a brown product, and potentially sustainability is an avenue through which the product may deliver, for instance, more features, more relevant features, better features, or even better quality sometimes. So it's at the heart of sustainability to resolve those trade-offs rather than see it as an either or type of approach. I think that would be probably the what I would call the latest thinking and the latest understanding in the sustainability world. Perhaps go broader, this is at the heart of what we consider business strategy today, because it basically says that what we considered as a competitive advantage before, it's radically changing. It is not just about the financial performance sometimes achieved through shortcuts, right? We have seen the VW case, for instance. It's about truly engaging and truly delivering socio-environmental performance. And how do you do that? Well, it's by truly understanding not only as a company, not only understanding only your economic context, but actually understanding the social and the environmental, and therefore being better able to identify the trade-offs that I talked about earlier.
Right, that's very interesting. And I think you've done some research which shows that companies can do both, can pursue sustainable strategies in a deep way and be successful financially at the same time.
Exactly. So once you resolve those trade-offs in a way that is profitable, way that is efficient, and in the way that speaks to the socio-environmental demands, in addition to the, let's call them, broader economic or cost demands, then yes, and I mean, this is not a small challenge, right? It's easier for firms to say, oh yes, the customers do not buy green and expensive products, therefore we're not going to produce them. In other words, hide behind the fact that some customers may not be buying these types of products, right? The leading companies do not, by definition, don't expect to be led by anyone. They take their own initiative, they change their operations, they change their structure, their governance structure, they change their degree of transparency and accountability of the entire organization, they adopt long-term horizons, and they, as I mentioned, they lead towards this way, and in the process coming up often enough with better products, higher profitability, while having a positive impact in the broader socio-environmental context.
In its purest sense, you pointed out that it's a challenging thing to do in a real sense, because there are real trade-offs to do. But when succeeding, it seemed to be a win-win situation. But yet, it seems that many companies are still quite a way along from achieving this or down this sustainability path. What are some of the impediments, would you say, stopping companies really embracing sustainability in this way?
Right. So there are a number of different, as I would say, categories, or in other words, different companies are at different stages of their sustainability journey. So to this day, of course, there are companies that say, well, sustainability issues are not relevant to what we do. We're just going to ignore them. There are other companies that explicitly may be greenwashing. They may perceive the sustainability movement as a PR exercise, and that's all they do. There are other companies that start slowly, perhaps more cautiously, with efficiency initiatives. So we're talking about environmental management, waste management, water management, and so on. Initiatives that speak directly to the bottom line, but they're not truly strategic. They're perhaps more operational. In many ways, they are necessary, but perhaps not sufficient conditions to create an advantage based on sustainability. And I would say that there's another group of companies that sort of almost mindlessly, they look left and they look right and they see what the competitors are doing, and they end up with a rather sometimes not so homogeneous or strategic portfolio of sustainability initiatives, which they adopt simply because everyone else does. And finally, we see a smaller set of companies that perhaps begin to perceive the integration of sustainability into strategy in the way that I described earlier. In other words, as part of the core purpose of business, as part of the attempt to build and establish and maintain a competitive advantage. And those are initiatives where we go beyond risk mitigation, we go beyond operational kind of updating in terms of the efficiency measures, but indeed we go into a core business. But I would like to note something here, because sustainability sometimes is judged by double standards. This is not atypical to what happens sometimes in strategy. For instance, if you think the 1970s, back then everyone thought that diversification is the way to go, the large conglomerate is the way to the future, and we saw a range of diversification initiatives, many times not thought through all the way, many times non-strategic, but done because everyone else was doing it. And what did we end up having? Well, we ended up having what we call the diversification discount. In other words, putting companies together in a conglomerate ended up destroying them and creating value. And of course, and consequently, we have the de-diversification wave of the 1980s. As a result, only some of the companies to this day, for instance, Cisco, know how to do M&A and diversification quite well. So now I think we're sort of going through that in sustainability. People thinking, oh, it's everyone is doing it, we should be doing it as well. Everyone is trying to integrate, let's see what our competitors are doing, and try to do that as well. So we're going into that phase in which everyone knows that it's important, and everyone tries to do what everyone else is doing, but only few companies have cracked the code. Unlike diversification decisions, however, the recent research that I did with a colleague at with colleagues at HBS, but others have shown as well, is that adoption of sustainability, or rather integration of sustainability, is not only a Monday morning decision, in the same way that when a company diversifies, they, you know, consider targets and then they just go and acquire one. Integration of sustainability involves fundamental change in the organization, and that's perhaps where the impediments come in, the serious impediments. For instance, we're talking about changing an organization's corporate governance. We're talking about having a person on the board that is accountable for sustainability. We're talking about changing and managers to reflect financial as well as non-financial metrics, because as in terms of behavior, sort of get what you incentivize. We're talking about changing from short-term to long-term thinking within the organization. We're talking about radically new levels of transparency in terms of reporting not only on the financials, but also reporting all these ESG, the non-financial factors, understanding their materiality and putting those disclosures out there without yet having, for instance, audited standards or standardized measures across companies and across sectors. Because it entails this, I would argue, never seen before process of change and radical change within the organization, it's as radical as a change in the identity of the organization. Think about the leaders in business today, like Unilever, like Marks and Spencer's, and so on. They really go all out, understanding that integration sustainability is an identity change. So, as with every change management process, there will be pockets of the resistance. There will be functions that do not get it. There might be functions that may be adversely affected in the short run. There might be disruptions of roles and responsibilities. If there's a change in incentives, some reorganization or internal restructuring is important. And perhaps the most important challenge is sort of communicating amongst the employees and amongst all the members of an organization that, well, it is practically the purpose of the organization that changes through engagement in sustainability, through integration of sustainability into a company's business model. So I would say those are the sheer sort of challenge, the sheer of the change is perhaps one impediment, but again, it's perhaps a differentiator between the best and the good and the very good or the bad companies in terms of who is able to achieve this.
Wow, that's quite a multi-dimensional perspective. There are many dimensions to this performing, truly integrating sustainability into the business. As you said, there are many companies who are maybe at the efficiency stage looking for cost savings and things like that. Companies are on different places on their sustainability journeys. The companies that have cracked the code, that have this multidimensional approach with taking into account governance, the board, incentives, and so forth, are fewer. How do you get there? Because there are so many dimensions here. It is, as you say, a different, you know, purpose in the company. It's, you know, effectively a different identity. What are a few of the levers that business leaders can use to execute this change?
Right. To be honest with you, this is we're now pushing against the boundaries of what we know, academically speaking. In other words, because the literature, the academic literature at least, has focused a lot on whether there is a link between sustainability and performance, and to what extent does sustainability contribute to better financial performance, and also because the availability of data, higher quality data, international compatible data across countries, industries, and so on is appearing only in recent years. We haven't had the chance as academics and as an academic industry, if you like, we haven't had the chance to explore the dynamic processes through which this happens. Because we do not have enough years yet, because we don't have enough data yet, because we don't have enough access to companies. But the big question mark, in other words, the change process to go from a low to a high sustainability organization is something that, quite frankly, has not yet been being explored. Exactly because we're talking about an organizational identity change, it involves so much beyond strategy. Right, because it's if you believe what I was telling you before about how radical of a change sustainability is, well, there are few, if any, departments within a company that will not be affected, and currently, perhaps not enough companies are undertaking such radical change in order for us as academics to go in and explore these issues. However, we do know, as I was mentioning earlier, that there are some organizational pillars that seem to be good starting points. For instance, the idea of integrating incentives for employees and for executives that are based on financial as well as non-financial metrics is a good starting point. Creating a board-level subcommittee that oversees the sustainability initiatives creates accountability as well as monitoring at the highest level. That helps as well. Secondly, the transparency of the organization, the idea that an organization needs to be open and engage with its stakeholders and not do so ad hoc, but rather put in place processes that are more structured. How do you engage with the stakeholders? How do you make sure that you understand their demands and expectations? How do you make sure that they understand your capability to meet them? To what extent are those engagements public and transparent to the stakeholder themselves, to your board, and to the public? In other words, explaining to all the stakeholders, to society perhaps, how you're engaging beyond the strictest economic domain. And to do so, to understand your stakeholders means that you also have you develop an understanding of what is material and what is important for your industry, for the business that you are in. That's another important step. Another thing that we have already seen companies do in their process of transforming is managing this trade-off between short-term and long-term. It is a well-known, and many people have said this already, but the story of Paul Polman and abolishing quarterly earnings guidance when he became CEO is an example of how not only adopting long-term horizons, but perhaps a more active management of one's shareholder base. Because ideally, if you're going to undertake this change management process, you would like to have a shareholder base that affords you this kind of a longer term horizon to implement. And quite frankly, if you take short term trading out of your stock, you decrease volatility of the stock as well, which is what happened in Unilever after what Polman did. And it's not just about the reporting. Look, for instance, the CEO of Starbucks, and it's a well-known, viral video by now, on how he responded to people that raised questions about the company's gun control policy or about the company's support for equality and same-sex marriage in the U.S. and so on. So the public and the transparent and the very obvious management of one's shareholder base, which is of course is intrinsically linked to leadership. Right, it is important to, as with every strategy, of course, it's important to have the CEO support. But in many cases, we see the CEO being the leader on these issues, and as always, the CEO is the one that will paint the new identity of the organization. So the role and the buy-in and the ability of the CEO to communicate these values and these objectives and these goals, both internally and externally, it's also quite important. So I don't think we have an understanding of the sequencing, but I do think, in other words, how do you do step one, step two, step three, specific enough? But I think we know the 3-4 organizational pillars, as I mentioned before. So it's the governance, it's the transparency and accountability, it's the stakeholder engagement, and it's also the long-term versus short-term decision management of the decision-making. Those are excellent starting points, and we know that organizations that have done that in the past and they became more sustainable, some of my work shows, are the ones that outperformed over a 1 or 2 decade sort of horizon.
The heart of this is this question of short-term and long-term. And I think what you were saying there about longer-term investors is quite interesting in the sense that I suppose sometimes it appears that we hear a lot of talk about short-term investors and so forth, but investors aren't homogenous, are all the same. And presumably there's some groups that have longer-term perspectives. There can be, I guess, some kind of self-selection or a better matching of investors and the kind of investors that a company needs to pursue in line with particular strategies.
What we found in the research that I mentioned earlier, I mean, a very crude sort of classification of shareholders is to talk about transient versus dedicated shareholders. So what that means is look at investors on the transient side. So those are the ones that trade more often and have more diversified portfolios versus those that have more focused portfolios and trade less often. So what we did find in that study with the colleagues at HBS that I mentioned earlier is that the high sustainability companies tended to have more of the dedicated investors, whereas the low sustainability companies, so what we perhaps call the more traditional way of competing, was more about the more transient investors, the ones that are more diversified and traded more often. So in that respect, not all investors are the same, and there are subcategories of investors depending on their sort of appetite for holding stock longer or shorter, that seem to select into the sustainable versus the traditional model of their organizations. One method that we found and we explored in this paper, through which one can sort of manage or build those expectations, is analyst calls. So in this study, we explored what the company actually talks about in the calls with analysts. And we found some very important differences. So first, the high sustainability companies have a better balance in terms of the way they speak about financial and non-financial metrics. And that, of course, is consistent with the idea that they account for all of their stakeholders, because typically non-financial metrics refer to measurements that relate to stakeholders other than the shareholders. So consistent with the broader idea of integrating those issues at the core of their business, these companies were not only more likely to measure these things and measure them better, but indeed to communicate these things in their analysts' calls. Secondly, we also saw not only the distinction between financial and non-financial, but we were able to codify the language and distinguish between a short-term versus a long-term focus. And again, in these calls, you can see that the high sustainability companies have a more a balanced perspective between the short-term and the long-term versus the more traditional companies that focus more on the short term. So and it's important here to see, though, that each of the pillars that I mentioned here and I mentioned before is that it's not sufficient on its own. Each one is necessary and each one complements each other. In other words, yes, of course, you can talk to your analysts about non-financial metrics and the long term, but unless you actually have accurate measurements, unless you're objectively speaking, the quality of your data is better, then though that talk is just talk, it's not is not credible. So the fact that you might have a person on the board, a subcommittee, incentives, you measure well, you have stakeholder engagement, all those elements come together in order to reinforce the credibility with which you speak to your shareholders, you speak to the analysts, and you convince them that what you're doing is actually not symbolic only, it's not greenwashing, but it's core to the business. So all those elements come together to reinforce each other and importantly reinforce the credibility in many respects and in how companies are communicating with their shareholders. And in another study that we did earlier, we asked this question. We asked the question of how do analysts perceive and evaluate companies with high sustainability ratings? And a lot of people would say that, especially if you go back to the early 1990s, that, well, the financial markets did not care. The financial markets did not even read these things. Well, what we did find was actually that the situation was worse than that. In other words, it's not that they were only indifferent, but what we found by analyzing the analyst recommendations, you know, from strong buy to strong sell and so on, is that in the early 90s, analysts were more pessimistic about companies that did well on sustainability ratings. Let me repeat that. So we found a negative association between their recommendations and good sustainability performance, which basically means that in the minds of analysts, engaging in these socio-environmental issues was considered as destruction of shareholder wealth. It's only in subsequent years and as the decades went by and in the early 2000s that we see that negative effect diminishing. And in the early 2000s, again, that effect becoming a bit more positive. In other words, we can see the transition, slow transition, but steady transition between the understanding that any involvement with sustainability is distracting shareholder wealth to the idea of a stakeholder focus and a stakeholder understanding of the firm, and therefore engagement with these issues being associated with more optimistic recommendations. And this is consistent with the broader story in that it's not, I mean, we find this trend on average among analysts, but it is the most experienced analysts and analysts that come from the best brokerage houses, in other words, the analysts of higher status within the community, that were the first ones to stick their head out and switch from the negative towards more neutral or at some point positive recommendations, which is consistent with this idea that if there's something new, it's the ones that it's the actors that have perhaps more capital, in this case, higher status, that might be willing to make the switch first.
Wow, that's fascinating. And it's a positive trend moving in the right direction. I'm interested
I'm an academic, so try to see this impartially as much as I have my personal views, but this is the data talking. It's not me telling the data what to say. And indeed, it seems that the trend is in that direction.
That's fascinating. You talked about this idea of sustainability being integrated into the business. I'm wondering what that means for managers within the business. I know that sometimes the old style CSR and sustainability was sometimes at risk of being a bit of a silo or isolated. And I guess over time, sustainability is becoming part of everybody's job in a business. Can you talk a little bit about that and some of the challenges that managers face?
Yeah, I think sustainability is an interesting domain in the sense that it sort of started as a low legitimacy, low credibility sort of domain. In other words, you would often hear the words of, oh, these are the tree huggers and so on and so forth. But with given the challenges that the world is facing today, given the social unrest in so many countries, given the increasing an existential threat that climate change is posing, it's very difficult, I think, today for any CEO or any executive to ignore this issue. So that has made sort of, I would say, life within this function a bit more easier, in the sense that these issues are now recognized and are on the table and their daily preoccupations all over the place. Now, my colleague, George Serafim, has an HBR on this, who kind of describes it's a book chapter that describes this process about the role of the chief sustainability officer. And again, although we do not yet have systematic research, because events are evolving in the field as we speak, what we do understand now is that this process begins more of an efficiency sort of contribution at the beginning. In other words, an environmental management system that contributes directly to the bottom line, which then gives credibility to the sustainability people, in the sense that our initiatives speak directly to the bottom line. So they are the internal leaders in any organization that through simple persuasion tactics and influence tactics rather than authority, are able to show the efficiency gains and start talking in terms of profitability, and perhaps sometimes they themselves learning the language of finances profitability in order to communicate their impact. Typically those are the ones that are assigned more and more responsibilities in the organization and go on to take leadership roles in sustainability. I think the story of Mike Berry at M&S fits across those broader lines, and I've heard him many times share that story. And I think that is a more generalizable story. It's a story about building internal legitimacy, learning the language and bridging the language between typically the sustainability function and, say, the CFO or the finance function, proving the case in terms of the efficiency gains. And then it's kind of making the step from an understanding regarding risk mitigation and operational issues to value creation. Because once one can see the benefits on the former step, it becomes relatively easier to see the potential benefits on the other. And that's exactly where we see the new business models coming in, by the way. For instance, we hear a lot these days about the idea of the circular economy business models, which are an innovative and a science-based, an engineering-based way to change the way we understand production and the way we understand consumption and even the way that we understand reverse logistics. So those are the implications in many respects.
You mentioned the question of ESG, materiality of ESG issues. They differ across industries. And I'm wondering, how can companies, you know, best identify these? And what kind of questions should business leaders ask?
Well, the good news on the materiality front is that this is an issue that relates directly to the company's disclosures, to how the companies report. So we now witness many initiatives, many key initiatives by many stakeholders in order to arrive at these reporting standards. And for instance, one that I know very well is SASB, that has already released materiality metrics for pretty much all the industries. So this is already done in many ways as the world is moving towards auditing standards. This is important also, and actually one of my co-authors, Bob Eckhoff, is advocating about this idea of a materiality statement together with the financial accounts. To be honest, it's hard for me to think how a company could not do this. In other words, it used to be the case that the discussion used to be about the fiduciary duty, and that companies may be breaching fiduciary duty by engaging on ESG or sustainability issues. But now the discussion has shifted, and most people would, I think a number of people would say that, well, it is a breach of fiduciary duty not to consider these factors. Now, in terms of how you arrive at it, obviously organizations like SASB, but also others, undertake this kind of more quantitative analysis in order to understand which issues are most important across industries. But the company itself should be able to do this through its stakeholder engagement processes. Remember, I mentioned before that stakeholder engagement is a key pillar of how a company can move to being a high sustainability company. The stakeholder engagement process, the idea of understanding demands and expectations across stakeholders, bringing on the table opportunities and risks across both sides, across the firm and its stakeholders, I think it's a very fruitful way of understanding, potentially prioritizing, and therefore understanding the materiality of these issues at the firm. So two-way stakeholder communication, I think, is key.
Right. And how challenging is that? I mean, how different is that from the traditional approach to initially shareholder communication, but broadening out to stakeholder communication?
Right, so I think it's not just a difference in communications. What we argue in some of our work, and I apologize if I become a bit technical, but the idea is that it used to be that people were thinking of organizations as, you know, property of or an asset of the shareholder, and therefore the job of the board of directors is to monitor management, essentially, so that management does not cheat. Right, in terms of generating profitability for the shareholder. So in that sense, it's what we call the principal agent problem. So the managers were the agents of the owners, the principals, which is the shareholders, and therefore the board was charged with overseeing and monitoring that the managers were not, quote unquote, cheating on the owners. However, you can imagine that under that model, shareholder is the supreme being. Everything happens for the shareholder, and the stakeholders are any other non-shareholding stakeholders are secondary. But now, and this is a discussion that's also taking place in the legal domain, is that, well, actually, legally speaking, even the board is not only accountable to the shareholders. Indeed, the board is accountable to the corporation. Why is that different to the previous model? Well, it's different because the second view conceptualizes the organization as a team. In other words, multiple stakeholders that make investments. In other words, the employees bring their time and their effort and they get compensated. The shareholders bring the financial capital and they get compensated with a return. The suppliers bring the raw materials and they get compensated in terms of their prices. In other words, there's a range of stakeholders that make firm-specific investments. According to the team production model, the role of the board is to be accountable for the corporation. And basically that means it doesn't manage vertical relationships between the shareholders and the manager, but instead it oversees horizontal relationships across all the stakeholders and is therefore accountable for the corporation, which basically means that the board, right, might in the short run sacrifice the interest of any one stakeholder, including the shareholders, in order to create a larger pie for everyone in the long run. Now, you can see this is the what we call the team protection model of the corporation, which is quite different from the principal agent model, but I think it's extremely useful in terms of understanding not only the role and responsibilities of the board of directors of a company, but also in terms of understanding the place of the shareholder. In other words, certainly all organizations should be profitable and maximize profits, but admitting that says nothing about how one goes about achieving that, how the process through which that's being achieved. And sometimes a sort of an obsessive focus on that has led to other failures, like corruption, like cutting corners, unethical practices, practices that harm the environment, practices that harm the community, practices that harm employees, and so on. I think the idea of thinking about corporations in a team production model seems to be make more sense going forward, and is consistent with the idea of integration of sustainability as part of the core business and financial and socio-environmental performance being synergistic to each other.
Wow, it's very interesting.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, by the way, the distinction that we did in the work that I mentioned earlier with my colleagues at HPS, that's how we chose the high versus low sustainability companies. And what we did show there is that over an 18-year horizon, these companies with a model that looks more like the team production model as opposed to the traditional model, in other words, the high sustainability companies, they perform much better in the long run, both in terms of operational performance, return on assets, for instance, or return on equity, and they also perform better in terms of stock market performance. And you can, you know, choose your favorite in the measure of performance, whether it's the ROE, the ROA, the stock market, whether you want to, you know, adjust for market momentum and risk profile and so on over the horizon. No matter how you see it, we find a strong outperformance between the for the high sustainability companies. So it's not that assigning responsibility to the corporation by the board is sacrificing shareholder returns. Quite the reverse. The research seems to suggest that a team production or something that resembles a team production model is actually delivering more returns for the shareholders in the long run.
That's very interesting. Sustaining that the argument there and showing the financial returns is very interesting. So what are the implications for the board of the team production model? Because the majority of boards won't be working like this today.
Well, as I mentioned before, it's questionable whether they do or they do not work like that today. There's a leading scholar, her name is Lynn Stout, where she's at Cornell, and she has written extensively about this issue. In fact, she has, in addition to her academic publication, she has a fascinating book called The Shareholder Myth. I would definitely recommend that to anyone to read. But the implications is exactly what I described earlier in terms of the four organizational pillars. Because think about it, if you care about all of the stakeholders, you're going to have a board subcommittee, and you're going to incentivize your executives to account for them. It means that you're going to be engaging with them. So the engagement is not going to be ad hoc, but there will be a stakeholder engagement process, which is the second pillar. You're going to be more long-term in your orientation, and you're going to communicate that to your investor base and your analysts, which is the third pillar. And you're going to be more transparent and more accountable because the stakeholders are going to require more information and higher quality information. So the theoretical argument that we make in that paper is that these four pillars characterize, in a sense, not only the responsibilities of the board, but how a team production model will translate in terms of an organization that, in many respects, manages and understands all of its stakeholders and therefore going back to sort of my opening definition, becomes sustainable not only in the financial sense, not only in the financial domain, but sustainable in the broader socio-environmental sense in a way that is complementary and synergistic to the core business.
That's so interesting. And it's clearly an area where there's a lot happening at the moment. As you say, you're researching new questions with new data and important work you're doing here. And thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I wish you the very best with your ongoing research.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. Please sign up at the sustainabilityagenda.com website or on iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.